Accession number 18258, real one.
Reg Dance, real one. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Abbey Wood, South East London.
Which year was this?
1919.
Did you grow up and go to school in Abbey Wood?
Yes. I went to school at the Abbey Wood Primary School in Bostall Lane. And from there I went to Plumstead Central School, which was situated near Plumstead Bridge and the Plumstead Railway Station.
How old were you when you left school?
I was 15 and a half.
So we're talking about 1934?
Yes.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I got a job. It wasn't terribly exciting in those days, but I took a job apprentice to an ironmongery and builder's merchant's firm in Woolwich, known as Lloyd and Sons Limited.
Is that what you were doing when war broke out?
No, I fell out with them after about 3 years. Well, it was in early 1939. I fell out with them and I'd had enough anyway. I was working extremely hard for a very poor wage, being an apprentice. And I left them, and then I worked for the man who was to become my father-in-law, who had his own coal business working from Woolwich Arsenal Station. And so I worked for him, controlling the coal stocks in the station yard, because he was supplying other coal merchants, you know. And he was glad to have me there. I was a pretty active sort of chap then, and I didn't mind shovelling coal and getting dirty. I enjoyed it. It soon came off with a wash, you know. And it was like that. And then it was obvious the war was imminent, and I read or heard of the fact that the police would like to have some people as, I think they were called special constables or something, or war reserve constables. So I went along to Plumstead Station and enrolled there, and I started having a few lectures there in the evening, and went out once or twice with a policeman on the beat. I had no uniform, but just to familiarise myself with it. And but then, of course, war broke out. I must backtrack a bit there. In that time, I was called up for medical examination and registered as whatever it was then, National Service Register, I think it was called, because my 20th birthday had just gone by. And going back to the police, I was with them, but then they received a notice saying, you can't have him, you can't keep him, he's due for call-up. And the police inspector called where I was living then and told me and asked for one or two things back. And I just sat back and waited for the call-up, which came within about 3 days.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I was excited by it all, let's face it. I was 20 years of age. My life had been a bit humdrum up to then. I'm not saying that I was fearless or anything else. I knew there was a tremendous risk. But the risk was there whether I was called up or not. That's the way I saw it.
And when you were called up, what happened then?
I went by train from Waterloo down to Blandford in Dorset, where they'd built a new camp ready, and we were the first intake there to train us as infantry. And I was enrolled there in the Essex Regiment. My number was 601-8787. You never forget that. And I did my training there.
What was the basic training like?
It was what they called heavy infantry, and it was mainly drill, let's face it. But that was to get this discipline into, you know, to obey the command and not argue about it. But we did quite a bit of marching, of course, and field work, you know, making use of field cover as infantrymen, and machine gun work, stuff like that.
How did the people in charge treat the recruits?
Well, it was a mixture, really. The junior NCOs had been obviously rapidly promoted in the then regular army and weren't quite up to it, but I could see the reason why. So they thought that probably bullying was the quick way through, you know. Not physical, but verbal, you know. More so than you would expect, but they gradually calmed down as we crept up, as it were. Senior NCOs, of course, they similar, but then that was the style of the army in those days.
Was the verbal bullying swearing at the...
Oh, yes, yes. What the bloody hell do you think you're doing and all this sort of thing, and even worse. And, of course, we were a mixed bunch, my platoon. We had a couple of young lads who'd come straight from university. We had a dustbin man from Deptford. We had people who'd been unemployed for 2 years, you know, and myself. We were a motley crew, there's no doubt about that. We had one chap, Cranston Bogle. Now, he was one of the chaps from university. He was a commercial artist. Now, that young fella ended up as the managing director of International Publishing, IPC, I think it's called, you know. So, and he was a wonderful artist. He did a drawing of me because I helped him while I was there, you know. He fell ill and he was put in the sick bay, and people were saying, well, I wonder how Cranston's getting on. And no one seemed to know, and I thought, well, I'm going to go up and see if I can see him. So I went up and saw the chap, you know, and he was all right. As far as I know, it wasn't a contagious illness. And asked him if he wanted anything. He said, oh, if he could only have an apple and a bit of chocolate or something from the naffy, which I got for him. And when he came out, we were sitting on our beds talking one day, and I was chatting away at all the others, and I happened to look across towards his bed, and he was sitting on the edge of the bed with a, seemed like an A4 type of folder. He was looking at me, and he was sketching away. And in no time at all, he gave me the finished article, and it was brilliant. He said, that's for thinking about me in the sick bay. So that was that. But quite a pleasant experience, really. He was eventually caught. He didn't go to France with us. He was pushed over into an officer cadet training unit together with the other England lad from university. So I never saw him again. But after the war, I did see his name mentioned by IPC, and a name like Cranston Bogle, you don't forget it, you know.
How did you feel about going into the Essex Regiment?
I was quite happy. To me, that seemed to be near enough, you know, Essex, just north of Kent. If I'd gone into a Kentish regiment, it would have probably been a little better, but I was quite happy with the Essex.
And what happened then?
Right, well then, it was round about Christmas time. I know we'd been told some people would get a bit of Christmas leave, others wouldn't. But then the next thing I remember was a pay parade, and the RSM said, as you leave the pay table, look at that blackboard. If your name's on it, straight through that door, you see. Of course, I could see my name. It seemed about foot high. You know, you always do when you see your name. And I went through, and I was giving two shots in this arm and two in that. And within 24 hours, we were down at Southampton on a boat across to Le Havre. And there was no time to write to anybody or anything. And to be quite honest, I was still wearing civilian shoes because they hadn't got enough boots there for us. And I had a civilian gas mask with a bit of string, which was in a cardboard box thing. Some had the service gas mask, but I certainly didn't, and I didn't even have a rifle. We were equipped with that when we got over there. But we went into a tented camp, not far from Le Havre, pouring with rain, absolutely appalling conditions. And the next thing I knew was that I was told that, together with about 20 or so other chaps from the crowd who'd gone over, were being transferred to the 1st Battalion of the Bucks Light Infantry, which was a rifle brigade unit. It was a single battalion of the Oxen Bucks Light Infantry, really, territorial battalion, but we'd been transferred into it. And from that camp, we went by lorry right up towards Lille on the Belgian frontier somewhere.
What date is this approximately?
That would have been just after Christmas of 39 Christmas, so it's early 1940.
And when we got, was this battalion called the 1st Battalion of the Buckslide Infantry or the Oxen Buckslide?
No, it was called the 1st Battalion. No, wait a minute. The 1st. 1st Battalion. No, it was 1st Battalion Buckinghamshire, I think. It's going back a bit. I've got my old cap badge somewhere.
Okay, anyway.
It was definitely a separate battalion, and I mean, it was separate because we wore regimental badges and insignia like the Rifle Brigade. Corporals and that had black stripes on a red cloth. The regimental badge was the Maltese cross with honours and that on it, on a piece, a round piece of red baize, red cloth in the cap badge, you know. So it was completely separate from the Oxenbucks. And life got a bit harder there because they were a territorial army battalion and they all knew each other by their first names, including the RSM. But the moment we got there, of course, the RSM said, right, well, you all have a haircut like mine. He whipped his cap off and he was shaved right down. So I lost all my hair then. I used to have quite a bit then, not now. And all the others did as well. And to me, we got the mucky end of the stick for quite some time, but we gradually moulded in and made friends and that. And, of course, in no time at all, we moved a couple of times, but we were in very rough billets. I know we were upstairs in an old barn, and there were cattle and stuff below us. And I forgot what the date was now, May the 9th or 10th. I woke up very early and I could hear the general alarm being sounded on a bugle, you know, which had a very coarse connotation in words. The sergeant major's got the horn, you know. Da 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 da. And I thought, so what's this, a practice? And I looked out of this loft door and there was this chap going past blowing on a bike. And then I heard aircraft. And a load of these Dornier aircraft came over about 300 feet, dropping bombs all over the place, you know. So that was the start of it all, you know. We were trucked a certain way up into Belgium, but then we had to march. And we marched until we got in the general area of Brussels. And I always remember when we stopped, we didn't know what was going to happen next. And then this captain came round and said, well, you may not know it, but you're now in the area of the Battle of Waterloo. This is the very slope. And we had to dig in trenches all along there. And just before dark, we got the order we were to hold that until the last man and the last round. And I couldn't believe it because, you know, it didn't seem right. We could hear plenty of gunfire, but a long way away. And at night, the whole area to the east of us was just flash, flash, flash in these moments. But then during that night, after stand two, you know, was propped up in the trenches, and I could hear this tremendous noise. And I was trying to make out what it was. It sounded like men marching, but now and then I could hear the clop of a hoof, and I could hear sort of engine noises. And as dawn came up, and I looked across to our left, on the ridge there was a road, and it was just solid with troops going back towards France. And I found out afterwards this was an entire French army that had was retreating through us, who had been further in, you know. And within minutes we got the order to pull out quickly, and I knew why, because there were machine motorcyclists with a rough sidecar, machine guns on, German, bypassing us across the open ground and going right the way around the back. So the great retreat had started at that point, you know. And that's all it was from then on. Every now and again we stayed, Every time we crossed a river or a canal, we were told, right, you know, hold this. That's where I fired my first shot in anger. Because it's amazing, you know. I often think that thousands of chaps went through the war and probably never fired a gun in anger at a target, a living target. But we'd cross this canal and take cover on the other bank. And after a while, I heard a motorcycle on the other bank. And I could just see the head of the driver above the reeds on the other bank. And I just watched fascinated, really. And then I saw someone stand up with a map. And obviously it was an officer, at least I think so. And I thought, well, this is too good a target. So I just aimed at it and down he went. But then, of course, later on, we had mortar fire coming over because he was obviously reconnoitering, you know. And then we went back and back till we got to a town called, I suppose the French would have called it Hazebrouck, but H-A-Z-E-B-R-O-O-K, Hazebrouck, Hazebrouck. And at that time, I was with the signal section of that battalion. So we were near to headquarters, which was formed up in the town centre. The town was empty of French people, they'd all gone. And then suddenly the RSM turned to me and said, you. And it was so noticeable, he picked out six chaps who'd come over from the Essex Regiment. And he said, there's an ammunition train pulling into the railway sidings. And it's got to be destroyed. Hand in your paybooks so that they don't know much about you. And go down, just take all the hand grenades you want, which we did. And we'd passed the big railway siding because it's a massive thing, rather like Crewe, you know, a junction of many lines. And we got down in there, and sure enough, there were German troops who'd just arrived starting to unload the wagons. So we got as near as we could and threw a hell of a lot of grenades and then scarpered, and it certainly caused a lot of pandemonium down, if nothing else. But then, of course, they were after us, and we just lost each other. But I remembered the route in, and I went the same way out. But when I got to the town centre, apart from lots of equipment and little fires of paper burning and stuff like that, there was no sign of my battalion or the headquarters. And I realised that they'd gone on again from there. So I tried to figure out which was north. I didn't have a compass, but you can usually tell. And I was walking up the main road, Parvey Road, you know. Then again, I heard a motorcycle and I took cover in the doorway. And way down the end of the road, I saw this German motorcycle come round, again with a little sidecar. Then one or two others, and they're looking and pointing up the road. And I still had my rifle, but I thought, well, that's not... And then I saw an anti-tank rifle. You've heard of these mentioned, I'm sure. A clumsy thing, really, but moderately effective. They were in this case, anyway. And there was one round which was in the breech. And I took that, and they stood talking down there, so I just aimed at the sidecar and let fire. You have a tremendous recoil from that, you know. And all that I saw was... Everything disappeared down. It must have hit the bike, I think, and splattered all over the place. But then I had to run like mad. And others came round and started firing at me, so I went into a little house. You know, the door was open. There was bread going mouldy on the table and that, and all this sort of thing, bottle of wine here, and it was in a shambles. And I hurried through to the back. I thought, I can't go out on the road. I go through to the back. And as I went through the back, there was a little sort of pantry room, and this lives with me all the time. And on the table was a naked body of a very old man. He was dead, he'd been dead for days. But he was laying there, laid out, not a stitch on him. And anyway, I just rushed through the back, and then I went over little fences and walls, still trying to head north, until I got to the outskirts of Hazebrouck. And I decided that I wouldn't go on the road, I'd head north over country. And I was completely alone then. And I went, a day or so, I suppose, going along as best I could, but always hiding up when I saw troops on the road. And then I came across a party of about eight, I suppose, troops, all various, one gunner, infantry, you know, odds and ends, who'd lost their units. So we kept together, and I don't know why, there was a corporal there, but he didn't seem to be much initiative. His idea was really, they couldn't go any further, they would give up. I said, well, I'm not giving up. I'm getting back, you know, because my sweetheart was back here. And I said, if we go now, as the light's going, we can make that wood. It was a very big wood, it was a forest, really. If we can get into there and keep heading north, we'll be right. And we got there, and we were making our way along, and then I came across quite a muddy trail, as it were. And I noticed on the tree was a daub of red paint. And I thought, well, this is someone leaving a guide mark. And sure enough, it went right the way through. A lot of troops had gone that way. And when I came out the far side of the wood, which took a good day to get through, we could then see British troops heading in the same direction on the road. So we'd got right through the Germans then. So we cut across then to the road. And I don't know if you weren't reminiscing that much, but we got there and I was walking, marching along. I hadn't had a wash or anything, you know, for days and days. And there were some gunners sitting on the side of the road, you know. And one of them looked at me as we sort of came to a halt. And he said, I know you. And I said, well, I don't know you. He said, you're courting a girl in Brookhill Road, Woolwich. I said, that's right, how do you know that? He said, well, opposite those properties is the married quarters of the Royal Artillery. I said, that's right. He said, and there's a gateway there with a guard on it. He said, I was on guard duty there, and I saw you come down the road. He said, she's got lovely auburn hair, hasn't she? I said, yeah. He said, well, I saw you snogging in the doorway before you went home. So it's a small world, isn't it? Anyway, he decided he'd had enough because he'd taken his boots off. And I said to him, you won't get them back on, but I left him to it.
And what company and platoon of your unit had you been in?
Well, I was in the headquarter company there at that time, but of course I never saw them again till I got back to this country. And I was in the signals section.
So, what happened next on your trek through Belgium or France?
It was a bit better going up that road, of course, because it was more direct for a start, and at least we knew we were with other troops. A few lorries going up, and then as they ran out of petrol, they just set fire to them because there was nothing they could do, and they couldn't get petrol. And then we were being dive-bombed a lot, and it smashed us all up, and people were getting hit badly on the road. So again, I took to the open country, and I was on my own again by then. And I reached what must have been the last canal round Dunkirk. I believe there is one there. If it wasn't a canal, it was a very slow-running river. And I walked along the bank one side, and there was a bridge, but it had been smashed right up. So I came back again, went the other way, and there was a bridge that had been blown, but it was half down. It was blown in the middle, so it was like a V, you know. And I thought, well, I can slide down that and grab something, get across the other part and clamber up. And that's the part where I came out. And eventually I could see Dunkirk, but I also saw German troops ahead of me. So, again, I had to veer around them, but I got down into Dunkirk, and of course that was like Margate Beach, except the conditions were different. It was absolutely crowded with people, and I could see these queues of men in the water going right up to their chins, trying to get on small boats, which went out to larger boats and then went off. And I was a bit despondent then, but I'd do better on my own again, you know. But I looked everywhere to try and find a boat or anything that would help me out, and I couldn't find one. And then the order came along that there wouldn't be any more boats anyway. And chaps were just sitting there waiting to be picked up by the Germans. But I headed, I think it would have been northeast again, up towards La Panne. And when I got up there, I noticed a wooden jetty running out into the sea that had been hit by a couple of shells, you know. But it went out quite a way. And I clambered onto this and got out to the end as far as I could. And, of course, I was over water then, but it was shallow. And I thought, well, it'd be all right if the tide came up. And I just fell asleep, you know. And then when I woke, it was dark. And what woke me was a boat banging the wood, you know, and I heard English voices, and I looked around and through the crack and down, I could see this very small yacht, little sailing yacht, you know, with just two men on it, and they were saying, there's no one here, come on, we've got to get back, and I shouted out, oh, and they said, how many are there? I said, it's only me. They said, well, you're going to have to fall down or jump down, and I leapt down. But unfortunately, I hit my head on their deck, and I still had my steel helmet on, and it must have banged me in the back and knocked me right out, you know. And I was on there, and the next thing I remember was someone saying, come on, chum, have a cup of tea. And there was this mug with tea in it, which I had a mouthful of. And then he said to me, do you want to see the White Cliffs of Dover? And there they were coming up, you know. And they landed me. I was the only one on that boat. They landed me, and I was soon grabbed by the people who were on duty there in the harbour at Dover. And before long, I had another cup of tea and a bun, and I was put on a train with thousands of others and was taken right down to Bristol. And I remember thinking, well, we're passing by London now, you know, round about the Bromley area, and my mother's over there not knowing what's happened, and I can't tell her, you know. But anyway, we got to Bristol. We were cleaned up a bit, given medicals and some decent clothing. And the local people invited us into their homes for tea and stuff, you know. And then suddenly we were told that we'd have to rejoin our units, but we'd have leave first, and we'd been notified while we were on leave. So all details were taken, and I came back home. And I didn't go to Abbey Wood. I got off the train at Woolwich because my sweetheart then, Maisie, she worked in Woolwich, you know. And I went up to the place where she was working and saw the foreman there. And he said, oh, I know all about you. I'll tell Maisie you're here. And she came running out with all the other girls looking at her, you know, embraced me, and that was that. And then I went home to my dear old mother.
Do you know the name of the little ship that rescued you?
No, I don't. I wish to goodness I'd had the names of the men too, you know, because it was such a tiny little boat. I'm amazed they ever got over there and to get back, you know. All right, they got back in the hours of darkness, but Germans were everywhere and they were ready to shoot at anything that moved, you know.
Do you know the dates that you left?
Yeah, that was June the 4th. There were no more people out after that day, or even the day before, I don't think, because they said to me on the...